We are continuing our study of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We've been talking about the beginning of Jesus' ministry and how He came preaching the gospel of the kingdom and how He is explaining in this sermon what the kingdom is and the purpose of the kingdom. And He's explaining what kingdom righteousness is all about. And so He warns them in the beginning of His sermon, "Don't think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them." God's word is not passing away. But He makes that warning because He's going to be telling them a lot of things that perhaps they didn't understand about God's law, things that were going to confuse them. He's going to be repeatedly saying, "You have heard that it was said this, but I tell you that." And part of what Jesus is doing is helping them correct some misconceptions. Sometimes He's helping them to see you're only remembering part of the law. People are only talking about part of the law. I want to restore to you the full teaching of God about what righteousness is. And I want you to understand that righteousness is not just about external actions. It's about what's in your heart as well. And so last week we talked about how it's not enough just to say, "I've never murdered anyone." That anger itself is a sinful thing. We talked about how it's not enough to simply not commit adultery, that lust itself is a harmful thing. And Jesus ends that teaching with this, with His instructions about if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, to cast it off. And the point He's making is, sin, even secret sin, even things of the heart that no one knows about, is serious. And it's so serious that you should treat it as if your limbs were in jeopardy, as if your eye were in jeopardy, that because your very soul is in jeopardy if you do not have righteousness in the sight of God, if you do not reflect God's righteousness in your life. So, we're coming in tonight to verses 31 through 37 of the sermon. We're going to talk about divorce and we're going to talk about oaths. So let's go ahead and just read verses 31 through 37. Someone want to read these few verses for us? So, what was the practice that had sprung up in Israel amongst, especially amongst husbands in Israel, as it pertains to divorce? And where did that come from? It came from the hardness of their heart, Larry says. And what had come from the hardness of their heart? Yeah, what was God's original intent for marriage from the beginning? That marriage would be for life. So let's go ahead and read, because Jesus addresses this question three different times, in Scripture, right? And so let's go ahead and read some sort of parallel accounts when Jesus talks about the same thing. In Mark chapter 10, verse 1 through 2, and this will help give a full picture of what Jesus intended as He addressed this question, because more than one person asked Him a question about divorce. And He gave the teaching. Mark chapter 10, 1 through 2. "And He left there and went to the region of Judea and began beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to Him again and again, as was His custom, He taught them. And Pharisees came up, and in order to test Him, asked, 'Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?' He answered them, 'What did Moses command you?' They said, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away. And Jesus said to them, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And then in Matthew chapter 19, you know, a very similar teaching. And the question that's posed there in verse 3, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? And Jesus gives the same answer in that teaching about divorce. So from the beginning, it was God's will that marriage be one man, one woman, cleaving together, right, and staying together. But because of the hardness of their hearts, what had happened? Okay. Yeah, so it's interesting to think about the old law and its purpose, right? That it was not just a moral law, it was also a civil law of God's people, a legal law. And it was governing a nation that was full of some people who were good and some people who were evil. And so there are lots of laws in the Old Testament about what to do when someone does X. Well, it doesn't mean that people ought to do X, but it's talking about what happens if bad things occur. And so there was a provision in the law of Moses for how to respond in these situations. It doesn't mean it was God's will that this occur, right? God's will from the beginning was that marriage be between one man and one woman for life and that it would endure. But because people were evil and doing evil things, the law dealt with divorce and had some teaching about how to handle that situation. But how were people reading that law? What had become the custom? For any reason. That's right. So Deuteronomy chapter 24 is most likely, you know, what Jesus is referring to when he says, you have heard that it was said, right? And Deuteronomy 24 says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and she goes out and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the man later dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife. So it's a very long passage talking about what are the results when this happens, but they stopped reading really quick, right? They stopped reading at the beginning where it says, oh, a man has found a reason to put his wife away. That sounds good to me. Let's not read the rest, because that's what I wanted to hear, that there's a way I can do this. And the passage talks about, for some reason of whether it's unseemly, whether it's indecency, it's unclear what that word really means, and that was the debate going on then. Well, does that mean for any reason at all? Or is it only for adultery, for some sort of sexual sin? Brother Bill.
But of course they could have seen how the Spirit then later uses Ezekiel uses a same word in his prophetic book to speak of Israel's adultery towards God. The only reasonable interpretation that they
But the practice seemed to be that people were using this as a loophole, as a reason to end a marriage for whatever reason they chose. And so Jesus' teaching is that's not to be the case. And so it's interesting to think what would motivate a man, what attitude in a man's heart would cause him to put away his wife for any reason like this? And think specifically in this time period, what it meant for a man to put away his wife because he found something that didn't please him about her. We think about it in, you know, our day and age where marriage is a casual thing, and men and women are equal and have equal rights and have, you know, both pursue careers and both have this very, you know, egalitarian system of ours. But in their time, when you put away a woman, what were you doing to that woman? Unless she was going to go back to her father's house, she's not going to get a job, right? So you're causing this woman to be in a very extremely perilous situation, right? To put away this woman. And what does Jesus even say about that? What are you doing to the woman when you put her away in that manner? You're causing her to commit adultery. Because what option does she have but to join herself to another man? Whether it's because she seeks the companionship or whether she just needs another man to care for her. And so what is the attitude of a man who would just put away his wife because he found something displeasing about her? Selfishness. Absolute selfishness. Thinking only of his desires and nothing of this woman. What else would motivate a man to take an action like that? I think selfishness is probably the clearest description of what's going on. But what else? Pride? In what way? Okay. And if this is people who are actually using this as a loophole to say for any reason, then it's, well, I'm better than her, right? I can do better. I thought she was going to be a good wife, but she's not. I can do better than this, right? So I'll try wife number two. And maybe I don't have enough money to actually marry a second wife, so I'm going to put this one away before I marry another. What else is going to motivate someone to take an action like that? Ambition. Mm-hmm. Covetousness, just the desire for another woman, right? This woman, it looks beautiful to me. I'm going to put you away so I can marry this other woman, which again is a form of just pure selfishness, and also just being capricious with your word. You've made an oath, a covenant with this wife, and you're just going to break it because it's not convenient to you anymore. It's not something you want to keep anymore. Brother Gene, you had a comment? Absolutely. Yes, and you know, historians suggest that was one of the main reasons why divorce happened in ancient Israel, was because the wife didn't bear children. I'm going to find a wife who will bear me children. So, you know, this is the sinful attitude that Jesus is trying to teach against, and his point is that you can't just think of yourself. You must think of her as well. That you're causing her to commit adultery when you take this action. And so when you approach marriage, you're not just thinking of yourself, you're thinking of your wife as well. And so what, you know, as Christians, what attitudes are we to have towards marriage in opposition to this, right? How do we approach marriage if we want to have the blessings that God desired for man and woman? How will we approach our marriage? Okay. All right. So let's take these one at a time, right? So first, there's just the commitment, as you said, one man and one woman for life, that it's binding. Right? What do you mean by that? Right, and that's what he's going to say, you know, that you might have separated yourself from her, but in God's eyes, that remains a marriage, and that's why it's adultery. Absolutely. So it's unbroken in God's law, in God's view. So, you know, we ought to understand that regardless of what actions I take, God has a view of my marriage, and God has an understanding of the promise that I made to my wife and my wife to me, and you know, just because we think that we've changed our minds, it doesn't mean that God has determined that we are no longer together. Absolutely. And then this idea of, you know, loving as Christ loved the church. And what does that mean? Selflessly. Absolutely. Right. So we've been saying, you know, Jesus' teaching here was against the selfishness of casual divorce. You know, We are to love our wives selflessly. I was thinking about, you know, preparing for this class. Well, what all did Jesus say about marriage? You know, let me think about all the things that Jesus taught about marriage. Jesus doesn't teach much at all about marriage. But he teaches everything about marriage, right? Because what does he say about marriage? That the two shall become one flesh. Doesn't that answer pretty much every question there is about marriage right there? I mean, you can certainly go to other passages written by apostles, right? And the inspired Spirit gives us lots of admonitions. But when it comes down to it, is there anything more profound than the two shall become one flesh and what God has joined together, not don't let man separate. It kind of answers a whole lot of questions to me, right? What is the picture in your mind when you think of what Jesus says here, that the two shall become one flesh? He says that you leave your father and mother and you cleave to your wife. Do you know what that word cleave really means? It's a weird word because it makes it sound like a cleaver and it's split apart, but cleave is you are glued, right? You are adhered together. You cleave together. You're stuck together, glued together. And the two shall become one flesh. What does that bring into your mind when you think about that?
Inseparable.
Unseparable? Pardon?
Head and body.
Okay. Yeah. So the idea of one organism, one flesh in that way. I mean, I'm kind of a simpleton. I think of a three-legged race, right? Have you ever done the three-legged race, right, where you have been tied leg to leg with another person for the purpose of entertainment, right? But if you've done one, it is such a great analogy for marriage, right? Because what if you're going to run a three-legged race, what do you have to do? Pardon? You have to pace yourselves together, right? You have to have the same pace. I think about, you know, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, this idea that the wife is the weaker vessel and that you give honor to the weaker vessel. And men and women don't have the same pace in a lot of different things, right? And you can't just leave them behind. You can't just ignore their peculiarities, and you can't, you have to acknowledge the fact that they're not like you, but yet you're together, right? And so you can't just do your thing and not worry about this person who's tied to you, right? What else do you have to do if you're going to succeed in a three-legged race?
You have to go in the same direction.
You have to have the same goal. Absolutely, right? So if one's going here and one's going there, so you have to have the same goals. You have to pace yourselves together. What else? Think about a three-legged race. You have to communicate. Absolutely. If you've ever done this before, right? Especially if you've done it with a child and they don't really know what's going on, you've got to talk and you've got to say, okay, we're going to go left and then right. Not right, then left. Right? And you have to start at the same time. And if you're not communicating, you're going to fall on your face. What else is true in a three-legged race? I mean, if one of you falls, you're both going down. Right? And if you're down, you've got to help each other back up. You're not going to get up without help in that sort of situation. You know, three-legged race, you're together until the end. You can't take the tie off until you get all the way across. You have to be committed until the end. You're bound close, right? There's closeness. There's a tight relationship. You're accepting that it's not the same as running your own race, right? That it might slow me down. It might slow her down. Neither one of you is going to run the race that you would run if you were on your own, right? So you're both accepting the fact that you're doing something different now because you are together and you have chosen to be bound together in this way. You've chosen to be one flesh. Yeah, that was my last point. You might as well laugh and have some fun, right? I mean, so it's absolutely key to a good marriage. So, I mean, Jesus analogy, again, he doesn't teach at length about it, but that description of one flesh says everything that we need to know about how to have a marriage that will be a blessing in God's eyes. Absolutely, yes. And so this is not, if you don't approach marriage as a spiritual union, then, you know, you're not going to have the marriage that two committed believers will have. Absolutely. So, you know, Ephesians 5 talks about marriage. You know, Larry already mentioned it a little bit. This idea of loving our wives as Christ loved the church. Think about verse 28 and 29. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one has ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. So, you know, drawing into the analogy that our sister brought forward of you know, one organism of a body and a head, that when we are joined with our spouse, we become one being. And I love this analogy about, you know, no one ever hates their own flesh. Every year when it gets cold like this, I pull out a guitar and I try to play the guitar. And I only do it like 2 months a year, so I'm terrible at it. I only do it when it's really cold out. And so I'm trying to do things on a guitar and my fingers will not do what I want them to do, right? And so you get frustrated at your fingers because it's just not working. I wanted it to do this and it's doing that and it's not pleasing to me. And so, you know, if I'm frustrated by my fingers and I say, that's it, I'm getting a hammer, and I'm going to beat on my fingers, right, to punish my fingers. I mean, the silliness of doing that. You would never do it. You would never harm your flesh because your flesh is displeasing you in that way. And yet, in our marriages, right, when our spouse isn't doing what we want, exactly how we want, in the way we wanted, right, well, I'm going to punish them, you know, and maybe I'm not going to pull out a hammer and hit anyone, but, you know, I'm going to give them a tongue lashing. I'm going to give them the silent treatment. I'm going to, you know, whatever it is that we do, and we think that we can punish our spouse without punishing ourselves. But if you're one flesh, punishing your spouse never works. You're punishing yourself every time. So, you know, think about that as we consider the state of our marriages and how we honor God and how we honor our spouses, and just, you know, how we can have a marriage that will be a blessing to us. You know, we are one being, one flesh, and so don't think for a second that we can punish a spouse without punishing ourselves. Any other thoughts about the right attitudes to have and how those are going to show themselves on a daily basis if our attitude towards marriage is what God wants? First Peter 3:7, we alluded to it before. We should probably read some of these passages. First Peter chapter 3. Verse 7, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you, heirs together of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So there's a spiritual aspect to the relationship that I have with my wife. If my marriage isn't right in God's eyes, it will hinder my prayers. And we are to be heirs together of the grace of life. So if we are going to enjoy in this life or the life to come, the grace of God, the gifts of God, we're going to enjoy it together or we're not going to enjoy it. Right? I mean, if we're really going to enjoy the gifts that God intends for us, we're heirs together. And that's what God intends for a marriage between two Christians. Colossians chapter 3, verses 18 and 19. Someone want to read that for us? Do not be bitter toward them. Do not be harsh with them. And so the relationship between a husband and wife, the wife submits to the husband. And that's possible because the husband is not treating his wife with bitterness, with harshness. He's loving her as Christ loved the church. And serving her in a self-sacrificial manner. Alright, so any other thoughts about marriage before we move on? So why does Jesus transition from this discussion of marriage to keeping of our word in Matthew chapter 5? At its very nature, marriage is the ceremony that we, most people here, went through was an exchange of promises, of covenants, of oaths, of promises to do certain things and not do other things. And so that's what the sinful man who would put away his wife is forgetting, that he's made a promise to this woman. And so, you know, if we are going to have a marriage that is what God intends, then we have to remember that we've made promises to each other. So again, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is His footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great King. And you do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil or the evil one. So what was the attitude towards oaths amongst the people of Israel at this time? Right. Making a show of how much you mean it, and depending on the words you use, and the oath that you state, that states how serious you are about what you're saying. And so what is Jesus' response to that? Scott. Okay. That's right. So he concludes the teaching with, look, yes is enough and no is enough, and we don't need anything else. And if that is who you are, and if your reputation is that of being a truthful person, no one's going to be demanding oaths from you, right? I have someone at work that I hear this person on the phone all the time, and one of their verbal tics is to always be saying, well, to be honest. And I just think, well, I mean...
So if you don't say that...
Right. So it's a strange verbal tick, and it makes me wonder about the times when she doesn't say that. But it's just a verbal tick. But I think if you have a habit of speaking in a way casually, making promises that you don't really intend to keep, being casual about the keeping of your word, then you're going to be in this position of always having to explain away and make oaths and convince people that this time you deserve to be trusted. But if you're a person of integrity who speaks the truth, then yes or no is all you will need. But what's wrong with taking of the oaths? Why is it a sinful thing? And in its very nature, what made it sinful to swear an oath using God Himself, by heaven, or by the throne of God? Okay. And the first items, swearing by heaven or by the throne of God, right, you almost have a sense there in which you're going back to the Ten Commandments, right? Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. What does it mean to take God's name in vain? To make it common. Vanity means worthless, right? So to treat God's name as if it's worthless, as if it means nothing. And instead of hallowing and referencing God's name, you are going to use it in a common way. You're going to use it as a tool, right? For your believability. Like a rabbit's foot that you pull out of your pocket, right? God is my tool to be believed. No, you're not reverencing God's name. You're taking it in vain. You're using it. You're treating it as something that's just to be used to profit you or whatever, in however you choose. So that's profanity, to use God's name in this way, or to swear on heaven or the throne of God. But then, like we said, even coming down to other things, Well, all these other things, they're created by God. They belong to God. They don't belong to you. You're not in control of them. And so, you know, it all flows from God in the end. But if you are a person of integrity who speaks the truth, you won't need any of this. Yes and no will suffice. And he says, so let your yes be yes, and let your no be no. And anything more than this is of the evil one, or is of evil. I think it's going to kill me. What do you think he means when he says that? Anything more than yes or no is from the evil one. You know, go ahead, Bill. I mean, think about the evil one. Think about the devil and who he is. According to John chapter 8, verse 44, Jesus says, "You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." So, you know, anyone who is dealing in you know, oaths because their yeses don't mean anything and their noes don't mean anything, they're of their father, the devil. And what is the whole point? Why is Satan the father of lies? Why has he chosen that as his vocation? He's a deceiver. Absolutely. God is the God of truth, of life, and everything he says is right, is light. You can bank on it, right? It is true by its very nature. And everything Satan is about fooling people, deceiving people, causing confusion, having people not know what they can trust and what they can't trust, who they can trust and who they can't trust. That's Satan's game right there, right? Is to sow that sort of division and discord and distrust amongst people everywhere. And if we've become casual with the way we speak and with the keeping of our promises, then we're living as Satan would have us to live in the world. Brother James. I don't know who you could be talking about. Brother Gene. Yeah, and so the making of a rash oath, that, you know, you don't, just like people don't own any of these things they're swearing upon, you don't know the consequences of what you're saying. And so don't be making oaths, you know, when you don't know what will come, you don't have the knowledge that God has, you don't have the foreknowledge that He has, and you ought to be careful with your speech. Brother Casey. And so, you know, we have to think about that in terms of our reputation for truthfulness, because we are, our role in the world is to share the message of the good news, the gospel, the truth of Jesus. And if we're someone who has a reputation of deceitfulness, can't be trusted, what is that going to do to our ability to share truth with others? Brother Clayton. Okay. Yeah, and so it comes down to integrity and honesty with yourself and with others, that you're not hiding behind anything, right? And you're being forthright and honest in all your dealings with others. James. Yes. Yeah, Brother Bill.
Well, and this seems consistent with the thread of the teachings that he's been given. He began with, I came to fulfill the law, it will not pass away until all has been fulfilled. And then he proceeds through a series of teachings, all of which are cutting to the heart of people. You can't, it's not enough for you to refrain from killing your brother as you scheme and plot to do that. You know, your heart can't have that anger and hate towards a brother that would then be to kill them. Your heart can't be full of adultery, even if you're, you know, you're engaging in this sort of hypocritical line drawing where you can go to this point and stop, and then you can't be false to your wife and justify it through some.
And our truthfulness is not just, well, I didn't swear to God. I only swore to Aaron. So I'm just breaking my word with Aaron, right? It's a big deal. It's not like I swore before God. Well, if I'm going to tell his creation a lie, then I'm going to tell a creator a lie. I mean, so to be, you know, casual with our word with other people, you know, that's not enough. If you're going to be righteous as God is righteous, if you're going to be, you know, you're going to have truth in your life reflected because God is truth. If you're going to live in His character, then you're going to be truthful with all people. And, you know, it's not going to say, well, I didn't swear before God, so I don't have to keep these promises. To reflect God's character is to reflect truth and honesty in all of our dealings with all people at all times. Let our yes be yes and our no be no. Thank you, sir.